Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, Susanna Caldwell of the Alaska Dispatch, and Ann Hillman of APRN. Steve, the theme song for this Memorial Weekend is Smoke Gets in Your Eyes. Smoke from forest fires is blanketing South Central Alaska. Tell us more.
Mornings.
What's the update?
Yeah, last few mornings, it's been here in the Anchorage area as well. We've gotten a taste of that smoke. We've got three major fires, I think, of concern. The biggest is down in the Kenai area, and that is the Funny River Fire. Right now, as of Friday morning, it's about 67,000 acres in size, slightly contained. There is some homes, some cabins near Testamina Lake that are of some concern right now. And so you've got some hotshot crews and other firefighters down there trying to build a fire line between the flames and those cabins. There's about 218 people as of Friday morning, again, at the time of our taping here, that are working this fire. And by the end of the holiday weekend, it's expected that it'll be about 500 firefighters working that fire. A lot of them will be coming up from the lower 48 as well.
I don't know if you remember. I don't, but maybe you can provide some perspective. The Big Lake Fire, the big fire of 15 years ago in the valley.
Yeah, not nearly the acreage, but you have so many homes and so many recreational cabins up there. We lost an awful lot of homes up there, and again, recreational cabins, recreational homes in that area. There were so many. This is in the Kenai Wildlife Refuge, and for folks who have been here a long time, it used to be called the Kenai Moose Range. Well, it's the Kenai Wildlife Refuge, and there's some folks who've actually called us and said this fire is actually good for the area because it's been overgrown.
Moose browse.
It's a great moose browse now. It's going to be a great prime habitat for moose after this fire is over. And hopefully, though, the key is no one gets hurt and no one loses a home. And so far in Funny River, I think that's been the case. Over on Tyonek, across the inlet from Anchorage, there have been a few outbuildings that have been whacked by this fire. No major structures, to my knowledge, that have been hurt, but about 2,000 acres in size. It's, again, somewhat contained. The big concern had been the village, obviously, but I think it's moving away from the village. Now another concern is the Beluga power plant and some oil containers there, some oil. I'm not sure what it is out there now.
The pipeline
is out there. That's right. So that's a big concern that's there. So firefighters are working that fire, try to build a line between that and
the solution
flames.
Or answer here is pray for rain.
This is it. It is, you know, this has been an incredible spring. And
of great beauty, as we know.
And this is why we live in Alaska, and this is why we endure the winters, is to have a great summer and a great spring, and we've got it just in spades this year. It's gotten hot, and it's been dry, and it did this very early on, and we haven't had any snow in a long time. We certainly haven't had any rain, and this place is a tinderbox, and so everybody's being asked to be very, very careful this Memorial Day weekend. And, you know, Anchorage isn't immune to this either. This could very easily happen on the hillside. It's very
we'll
dry.
We'll see where the fire is next weekend or next week when we're back here with Alaska Edition. Susanna, Providence Hospital is opposing MLP's proposed rate increases, which would affect everybody, obviously. Providence is a big consumer of electricity, so there's a lot at stake here for these players.
There are, yeah. Providence is the oldest and largest hospital here in Alaska. And for them, this rate increase could mean millions of dollars more that they'll have to pay a year for electricity. Right now, MLMP is looking to increase its rates by 22% in this two-phased project that'll be in effect by 2016. Beyond that, there's even more in rate increases, but they're not really clear at this point how much that will be. Based on the early figures, Providence has said that their electricity bill is going to go from $4.4 million in 2012 to $8.6 million in 2019. That's all based on these filings that they had with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska last week.
Now, if I might, MLNP has to explain slash justify the rate increases. What is their argument?
Well, right now, these rate increases are for two projects that they have been a part of. One is the South Central Power Project, which they own 30% of. The other 70% is owned by Chugach Electric Association. That plant came online last year. The other one is they're upgrading their power plant here in East Anchorage. It's set to cost about $325 million, according to the latest Regulatory Commission filings. So big increases, and they're looking to spread that out among all of the residential and commercial customers. Obviously, commercial customers are very concerned because that's millions of dollars versus what residential customers will pay, which is, you know, $10 to $20 on their monthly
bill.
Now,
the mechanics of this, there'll be a hearing and then a ruling, or a series of hearings and a ruling?
Right. I mean, the regulatory process takes a long time. It can take months or years. And right now, they're working through all of that. Right, they have all their filings. The stakeholders like Providence and Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson have submitted their arguments against this rate increase, which they say that Municipal Light and Power, they should be using more money from their savings account to pay for this project, that they should have had maybe a smaller plant, that they should work more with customers to have these energy saving plans, and that Providence itself has tried to generate some of its own power with this combined heat and electric
what
system.
What is MLP's response to these arguments?
It's complicated. Right now, MLNP, they have opposed Providence generating its own power. I'm just saying that it's sort of a safety issue for Providence to create its own power, even though Chugach Electric allows for people to generate their own power based on their interconnect agreements. So Providence is sort of fighting this right now.
So there's some big regulatory technical questions that are involved.
And it'll be months and maybe even a year or so before they all get settled.
Okay, we'll have you back to explain it in a month or a year. Anne, the Anchorage School Board has passed a budget that reinstates some teaching positions, but the school board faces financial shortages for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, so basically what happened is that the legislature did vote to give more money towards what's called the base student allocation. It's like how much money you get per kid that's in your school. But they're only increasing it by a small amount. So $150 and then $50 and then $50. So the school district will be getting more money from the state, but it's not nearly enough to cover what would be, if you involve inflation and all these other things, it's not nearly enough to be the same amount that would be budgeted to cover all the teaching and other staff positions from this year. So they had to cut. They got the more money from the legislature. They reinstated some of the positions, but they're still looking at a potential cut of 555 positions from 2015 until 2018.
And how does the legislature respond to this kind of information? I mean, this is pretty dramatic.
I mean, that's a big debate that's been going on for a while, because you've got advocates saying, "Hey, listen, this is the future of our children. You need to be putting more money." And you've got others who are saying, we don't have that money anymore. So, I mean, this is a debate that's been going on for years and years and years. And what it's ended up resulting in is, yes, positions being cut, but also the school district here in Anchorage and other places having to come up with slightly more creative solutions. So,
and the decisions tend to be interim. In pieces.
Yeah. I mean, so for example, this year, when they were at school board a couple nights ago, there was this big discussion, all right, do we save money by cutting back on planning periods for middle school teachers? Or do we go ahead and put in more teachers in place so that people can have more planning periods? How does that impact the students? And Betty Davis, who's on the school board, was saying, listen, we have the money now, let's use it now. Whereas others were saying, wait a second, like there's gonna be future cuts down the line. How do we temper all of this?
This sounds like a problem for a philosopher king. Susanna, more and more Alaska farmers markets are accepting food stamps. Please tell us why the government has approved this approach and how it works.
Well, so this is part of sort of a national movement right now to get more low-income Americans into farmers markets. A few, you know, food stamps are, they're better known as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. They used to be paper, but now everybody gets their food stamps on these cards, and in Alaska they're called Quest cards, and they're debit cards essentially. That's great for when you go to the grocery store. It's not so great when you go to a farmer's market and people are only accepting cash or check. So over the last few years, starting in 2011, a few state agencies came together, the Department of Health and Social Services, the Division of Agriculture, the Division of Public Assistance. They all came together and they have put these electronic banking machines, or debit card readers essentially, into, they started with two farmers markets. That was the Spinard Farmers Market here in Anchorage, and then the Homer Farmers Market. It turned out to be pretty successful in that first year. Those two markets took in $13,000.
If I might, does the market have them as some organization, or the individual vendors get approved and then they have them?
The market gets it. So what you would do is you go to the farmers market and you take your Quest card, or they actually read debit cards. So if you show up to a farmers market and you don't have cash, you go to the machine and you give them your card, and they give you these tokens that you give to the farmer.
Okay.
Yeah, and then the farmer is reimbursed at the end of the day. So it was really successful that first year, and it's only doubled, quadrupled. Now there are 11 farmers markets. They're still figuring out if there could be a few more before the season's out, but I think that's the number they've settled on for now, that have these electronic debit readers all across the state, Sitka, Bethel, you know, Anchorage, Fairbanks. And last year, 10 markets brought in $114,000. So that's money that's going from this federal program directly into vendors.
Part of the theory here is that people who are using these cards will be buying healthy food that'll be good for them.
Right. It's supposed to help combat obesity by encouraging people to have better access to fresh fruits and vegetables. It's been very successful. There's also been this matching program that's been going on since at least last year, where if you go and you use your SNAP benefits, then you you get your money doubled with these state grants. So someone spending $20 in SNAP benefits could get $40 on these match days. It's to kind of offset that idea that produce at farmers markets is more expensive than at the grocery store, which is not always true.
I suppose there would be some things that you see typically at the farmers market you wouldn't be able to buy with one of these cards. For example, I've seen Oriental food vendors selling meals. You wouldn't be able to buy that,
You
right?
can't buy that. You can only buy food that you can prepare. So, yeah, you could potentially buy a loaf of bread if it's packaged, but you couldn't buy a donut. Stuff like that. There are some questions, though, over this matching funding. The state's been spending $50,000 this year to help with the match program all across the state. For example, the Spinard Farmers Market, every weekend will be a match weekend versus it was only like one a month last summer. It looks like that funding might not be there next year, and there are kind of some questions over.
And the consumers, what do they have to say? Like, presumably, they like it. That's why they're spending their money.
Oh yeah, they love it. Yeah, and the vendors are really excited because you know that's more money that they can have. So yeah, it's good for health and good for the economy.
Thank you. And Aklutna, that is the traditional native village, not the water project, has received some help from the Anchorage Assembly in the form of zoning regulations that will help them manage their lands and, in their judgment, protect them. Tell us about that.
So the native village of Aklutna is the only native village within the municipality of Anchorage. And so all of Anchorage is ruled by what's called Title 21 zoning laws, determines like what you can build, where, all those sorts of things. So what they've done for the native village of Aklutna is basically given them this exception on this 102-acre parcel of land, basically saying, listen, you're part of our city, but we're not going to force you to have trails. We're not going to force you to have utility easements or transportation that's going to bisect your village and impact your way of life. It gives this community a way to continue living in a traditional Alaska Native lifestyle because it is the oldest settlement in South Central Alaska of Athabascan.
Continuous, peoples. Yeah.
Yeah, continuous. So it's, they received a standing ovation from everyone in the crowd because it's a way to protect another group of people.
And I gather there was some opposition from at least the municipal attorney. What did he have to say, Dennis Wheeler?
Well, from the attorney and from Assemblymember Amy Dombowski, the concern is that a lot of this land, it's not just owned by the village, it's also owned by the corporation, because ANC's a corporation. And basically, you're giving, the city is giving away rights to do things on the land that they would normally have, like put a utility easement through. And so, is it too dangerous to give basically veto power to a corporation over something within the municipality of Anchorage? And ultimately, the assembly decided that no, it was, in this case, it's worth the risk because it's a very small.
And what did Mayor Sullivan have to say?
He actually had was not at the meeting at the end of this.
That's what I thought. I didn't see him quoted in the story. I was kind of surprised.
Yeah, he had ducked out. I'm sure he's a very busy person.
Okay. Steve, Senate Republican candidate Joe Miller says his opponents are all wrong about global warming. That is his opponents in the Republican primary, although I assume he would put Mark Begich in there too. Mm-hmm. He says they're wrong because they believe human activity has contributed to global warming. Miller got a front page story out of this, but did you get anything else?
Well, I think as far as playing to his base, to his constituency and potential voters, this issue is right in his wheelhouse. He had a long list of times and places where Mead Treadwell and Dan Sullivan, his opponents in the GOP primary, had come out and basically said one way or another that the problems of global warming and climate change are caused by human activity. This is something that Joe Miller refutes. He says this is just, you know, if it's happening at all, this is just cyclical, this is nature happening, and he doubts as well that it's even happening. So I think it plays to his base. I think he's obviously easily the most conservative candidate in the GOP primary in the Senate race. I think he tends to attract very conservative members of the party. So yeah, this for a primary, this is a great issue to attract the folks on the right side of the
party.
And
Mead Treadwell, who has in part staked his campaign on science,
yeah,
his experience with it, what does he have to say?
Well, he says, yeah, we want to see the science. You know, he wants to see what the science shows. He has said in the past that there are human concerns, human causes to climate change. He also wants to see the science. I think that there's still there are so many theories and reports that contradict one another. I think everybody's still waiting for a clear answer on
well, here's something that interested me. In the New York Times, Governor Jerry Brown of California wasn't waiting. He said, and this is a quoting from the Time, paraphrasing in other words, portraying California as the front line of climate change, Governor Jerry Brown said Monday that the effects of man-made global warming were devastating the state of California. Mm-hmm. I gather that is something that gets very little resonance here with our elected class.
I think it probably wouldn't, but I don't know. Jerry Brown says California is on the front line. I think there would be a lot of Alaskan natives in the northern part of the state that say we're on the front line of this thing. We're ground zero. We've been feeling the effects of climate change for years before any other part of the lower 48 has felt it.
So I guess part of what I was thinking here, yeah, too, is that for Governor Brown, who's running for re-election, and wants to be the longest serving, mm-hmm, governor in California, he thinks this is good politics with his constituents, I presume.
I'm sure he would. And in our state, we have a conservative state. We have a state that's highly dependent on oil and hydrocarbon production. And, you know, that doesn't sit real well with us if they're saying that this is what's causing that problem.
Susanna, promoters of the legalization of marijuana held a seminar on, well, how to get on the ground floor of the cannabis growing industry. Apparently more than 100 people showed up and put out $400 to receive this wisdom. What did those who attend learn? And isn't it a little funny that we haven't passed the legislation yet? We need to legalize marijuana before we can sell it in the fashion that was discussed here.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, that's definitely an argument to be made, but I think that there are a lot of people out there who are willing to pay. They paid exactly $420, which is sort of, you know, a little tongue-in-cheek, but anyway, yeah, I mean, but people are just looking to get their foot in the door and, you know, figure out where can they have a place if marijuana is actually legalized. I mean, right now, some polls have shown that it's just people in favor of this initiative, which is going to go to voters in November, it's a little over 50%. So, yeah, I mean, they were there at this thing. There were people of all different stripes, you know, just businessmen or recreational enthusiasts, I guess you could say.
And what were a couple of the pointers that were presented to those who might want to get into business?
Well, this Alaska Cannabis Institute, it's actually a couple based out of Tacoma, Washington, which they have passed their marijuana legalization, I believe it was last year, and they're working towards trying to build this industry. So they were trying, you know, they had lawyers and other industry specialists from Washington kind of explaining some problems that they've had and some possible solutions. I mean, Alaska has no sort of groundwork for this. In some states, there are dispensaries, right, for medical marijuana. Alaska has none of that.
Like in Colorado could just expand their medical marijuana dispensaries, and Alaska has nothing.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, the initiative as it's written, I mean, it talks about, you know, taxation at like $50 an ounce for marijuana and where this would be housed within you know, the state government in terms of taxation and, you know, all the issues in terms of who could have it and who could sell it. But it doesn't really, like, build sort of a network on how you would actually sell it and how you would,
One of the things that was quite interesting about what happened in Colorado and Washington is the problem the business people who are selling marijuana are having with cash because they can't use credit cards, and all these stories about them with bags of cash going to the bank. Is that something that they talked about? I assume that would be replicated here.
They talked about how, you know, there's, you know, people are coming with these bags of cash and they smell like marijuana and people are Febrezing the money to try to get the banks to take it. Because, yeah, I mean, there are some questions with how is this going to, you know, interfere with federal law? So yeah, I mean, they talked about that. They, you know, a lot of it was pretty standard sort of business stuff, a lot on the legalities, a lot on, you know, be good businessmen, don't, you know, look like ruffians or something like that. So yeah.
Okay, on that note, and biking in Anchorage, people who study bicycle use can tell us the percentage of Anchorage residents who bike to work and if their numbers are growing. Who prepared these numbers and what do they tell us?
So it's from census data.
Is that right?
Yeah, the American Community Survey that happens every year, and then the census data. They track things like how do people get to work? So that includes methods other than just taking your car. So looking at the data, bike commuting in Anchorage is up 151% since 1990. The grand total is 1.1% of adults, which doesn't seem like that much.
Yeah, when you sent me some notes, I was sort of scratching my head because you have the giant numbers over here and small numbers over here.
Well, the thing is like nationwide, it's 0.6%. And we're in Alaska where it's cold. Mm-hmm. And it's still 1.1%. And the numbers are rising. So that's actually 2012 numbers. And anecdotally, people have seen even more people out there nowadays. And if you look at numbers for the whole state, in fact, Alaska is number 6 for adults biking to work and number 1 for walking to work. So, yeah, statistically.
It's because your car froze up.
No, it's not, though. I mean, partially it's smaller communities, so it's easier to get places.
Yeah.
It's people just saying, hey, this is a healthy way to get out there. And now I've got a fat tire bike, so I can do it in the winter, too.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of things motivating this.
I can't remember. I'm sure I answered these questions, but was there anything seasonal in there so we know?
There's not. And in terms of local stats, the best local stats are actually just looking at Bike to Work Day, which was 1,400 people in 2007 and 3,800 people in 2012. Mm-hmm. There was a dip because of the snow last year. Mm-hmm. So there really are numbers actually showing the anecdotal evidence of more people out there on bikes. There's increased sales in bike stores. More people, Bill Papp over at the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation says it actually attracts businesses because if you've got a good bike infrastructure and people are out there and feeling safe on their bikes, it's going to bring young professionals who are used to being active in other parts of the country.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. Steve, we have a new report on the alleged rape at the National Guard and the alleged cover-up. Mm-hmm. The Inspector General came up with a report for Lisa Murkowski. The report hasn't been made public, as I understand it, but there's been extensive discussion already.
Yeah, she received sort of a synopsis, I guess, or like a one-page report highlighting what the Inspector General found. Some of the biggest concerns was there a cover-up by higher-ups in the Alaska National Guard over sexual assaults? According to the Inspector General's report, and they're a neutral agency in the military, from what I understand, they say there was no cover-up, that there was no effort by leaders and higher-ups in the National Guard to suppress these reports or to intimidate anyone from coming forward. And the Inspector General's report also said that the investigation was handled properly and that sexual assault evidently is not a major concern among the rank and file of the National Guard. They say it's not a major
issue.
Where
does this leave the public? Because the people who brought these charges were so impassioned and so certain.
Yeah, and the people who brought the charges aren't convinced about the IG's report either. There's some questions. There's one gentleman who's one of the major whistleblowers in this. He said he wasn't talked to by the Inspector General's investigators. Witnesses, evidence wasn't considered, according to what he's saying. So I think there's still going to be quite a few questions left over after this full report comes out. And I don't think there's a date as far as when this report will be released to the public. But it sounds like there's still going to be quite a few questions that are going to linger on even after this is made public.
Very briefly, can Governor Parnell now say, "I told you so"?
Well, yes, sure he can, and he probably will. And again, the Inspector General's report, this is supposed to be a neutral agency, so I think he can say that at this point. But I don't think that's going
to quiet
anybody.
We're out of time. Thank you very much for joining us here. We'll see you next week on Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.